because I understand how exciting it is for her. And, you know, she has a sensible horse. She's really, you know, she's practiced. I feel that ultimately she's in a safe environment. She's got a back protector. She's got a great hat. You know, we've done what we can. I personally am more worried when she cycles down our village single track lanes where cars are allowed to go 60 miles an hour. That for me is way more scary. But ultimately, she's a sensible rider and she understands the risks. She doesn't want to get injured. Ironically, most horse injuries happen when riders are off the horses.
All right.
So actually, it's pretty rare. When you look at kind of injuries sustained with horses, the vast majority are when, you know, you're picking out their hooves, you're brushing their tail rather than
riding them. Well, Marina Fogel, thank you very much for talking to us. That's all we have time for today on Times at One. Thank you to producers Maxie Allen, Joe Crook and technical operator Ryan Boyden. I'll be back tomorrow at the same time. And I'm pleased to say I've been joined in the studio by Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. Horse riding? Yes or no?
No. No. Terrified of horses. Terrified of them.
Well, on that note, I'll leave.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you very much, Joe. 2 o'clock, you are listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And coming up in the next 2 hours, we're going to fact-check Reform's plans to deal with small boat crossings. The authors of Unmasking Lucy Letby will be here to give us their consensus on the nurse serving life in prison. Our big interview is with Alex McBride on season 2 of the real-life courtroom series The Jury and Big Cat Sightings.
Yes, we are talking big cats. We've got the big cat man with us between 2 and 4 this afternoon. Let's have the news at 2. Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Nigel Farage has warned that the small boats crisis is a threat to public order, claiming the arrival of migrants is an invasion. The Reform UK leader has been setting out his ideas for dealing with the issue, including mass deportations. He says if Reform comes to power, they'll repeal the Human Rights Act and quit the Refugee Convention.
What really bothers me is, and you've seen this from the Bell Hotel onwards, the growing concern with justifiable evidence that women and girls are far less safe on the streets than they were before this began. So it's all about whose side are you on? Whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the British people or international treaties?
Labour have called the proposals an unworkable gimmick. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says Mr Farage's plans look familiar.
Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. The fact is Nigel Farage is copying our homework. We put out a deportation bill in May. The stuff that actually works and what he said has come from there. But the truth is, he is not doing the thinking. We are.
An appeal against a High Court decision to ban asylum seekers being housed at the Bell Hotel in Epping in Essex will be heard on Thursday. It's been the site of several recent protests. Relatives of a woman killed in a helicopter crash say they're struggling to cope with the loss and are asking for help bringing her body back to Poland. Justyna Czoska and Wojciech Kowalkowski were passengers when the helicopter came down on the Isle of Wight yesterday. Protesters have shut down major roads in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, calling for a deal to free the Israeli hostages in Gaza and end the war. They're concerned a widened Israeli offensive puts captives taken by Hamas in October 2023 in danger. Meanwhile, attacks have continued in Gaza the day after 5 journalists were killed in Israeli strikes. Dominique Pradeli is the president of the International Federation of Journalists.
When you hear the Israeli spokesman saying the Israeli army doesn't target civilians, it's a complete lie. When you have killed more than 60,000 civilians, 200 journalists, how can you say that? And it is a complete scandal.
The Health Secretary is warning pharmaceutical firms are making unaffordable demands on the NHS and some patients may be denied life-saving treatments. Last week, Wes Streeting ended negotiations over renewing a tax deal that saw the firms pay clawback tax on drugs. He told The Times the government will not be a pushover. Richard Torbit, Chief Executive of the Association of British Pharmaceutical Industry, says he hopes the government will come back to the table.
The payment rate that companies have had to pay back from the government government has really got out of control in recent years. At the moment, companies are having to pay back almost a quarter of their revenues to the government, which is way in excess. And that's at a time where the yardstick by which NICE assesses cost effectiveness hasn't actually moved for 25 years.
And for news when you want it, subscribe to our podcast, The Times News Briefing and The World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Good afternoon. We're here until 4 o'clock. Hope you're fit and well, had a decent weekend. If you want to chip in this afternoon, the WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353. In the next couple of hours, reform's big idea to stop the boats. That's our first topic this afternoon. We'll have a look at the questionnaire designed to protect people at risk of domestic abuse. The safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, says it just doesn't work. We're going to be asking if there's any alternative. In health news, we'll talk about the chatbots offering mental health advice. Apparently, they're very dangerous. Big cat hunter Rick Minter is with us. Are there really panther-like creatures roaming the English countryside? And we'll talk too to the authors of Unmasking Lucy Letby, the journalists Judith Moritz and Jonathan Coffey, with us at around about 3:15 this afternoon. That is a case that just about everybody has a view on, so I'm looking forward to hearing what they think. Judith Moritz was at every single day of both of Lucy Letby's trials, so she should know exactly what has gone on. The big guest is Fee. It's about a TV show that I think starts tonight.
It's Alex McBride, KC, and he is one of the experts who gives a kind of commentary on the new season of The Jury on Channel 4. So if you didn't catch Series 1, the premise is very simple. The production team and Channel 4 have taken the transcript from a real life trial, and that is performed by actors in a courtroom where real people have signed up to be part of an experiment to act as the jury. And so much of the TV show is filmed in the jury room to watch their deliberations to try and work out just how lacking in prejudice any 12 men and women called in off the street from all parts of society can really be, and therefore whether or not you would get a completely different verdict in a trial based on who the jury are. So it's a rich seam in fiction to imagine the jury room, but it is impossible to have that as fact, because no photography or recording or even stories from the jury room are allowed within our judicial system. So it's really fascinating. Alex McBride has lots to say about the judicial system in a wider sense, but we will primarily be talking about being on a jury. I know that so many people listening will have been on a jury, and we know that you can't talk about the specific case that you bore witness to, but if you've got anything that you'd like to say just about your thoughts on the other jurors and the verdict that you reach, we would definitely take those. We can make them anonymous.
It's interesting that we're also talking about the Lucy Letby case today, because in this very, very well-written and well-researched book by Jonathan Coffey and Judith Moritz, there's quite a lot of references to the jury, because in the first trial, it went on for over 9 months. So the jurors had to suspend their entire lives to listen to some really, really harrowing evidence. And they went through a great deal. And actually, at the end, the judge said that they didn't ever need to do jury service again. And he acknowledged that they'd been incredibly diligent, hardworking, thoroughly decent about the whole thing. But, I mean, what a thing to turn up at a courtroom and to find yourself sitting on a trial like that, 4 months on end. It's such a commitment, such a tough thing to do. So we'll talk about that a little bit later, and we'd love to hear from you. 0333 003 2353. So the big news of the day, Nigel Farage has pledged that in government, reform, which currently, we shouldn't forget this, has 4 MPs, would leave the ECHR, and he promised to stop the boats crossing the Channel within days. The Reform Party's leader was setting out his party's deportation plans this morning.
I repeatedly went out into the English Channel, filming what was going on, saying you may as well put a sign on the White Cliffs of Dover saying everyone welcome. And unless we start deporting people, I predicted this would turn into, and yes, I use the word, invasion. But 180,000 people later, what other word could possibly describe what has been going on. It is an invasion as these young men illegally break into our country.
Nigel Farage earlier on today. Let's briefly have a word with Aubrey Allegretti, who is the Times chief political correspondent. Aubrey, you were at this big set piece speech this morning. What was the atmosphere like?
Well, it was interesting, I suppose. I mean, Reform has been holding press conferences every Monday throughout the summer on a campaign of Britain is lawless. They were sort of building towards this moment. And so it was all set in an aircraft hangar at Oxford Airport. We had a giant Union Jack, I think it was 18 metres long, and then some significantly sized props, departures and arrivals board featuring the top 10 nationalities of illegal migrants who come to the UK every year. I would say that it was sort of a tone that Nigel Farage was trying to create, one of sort of sternness, of trying to show that the situation facing the UK was a real crisis. He talked about there being an invasion of small boat arrivals, and we heard a little bit more detail about some of the policy that Reform says that it would institute, but it was still lacking in some areas as well.
Lacking in what? In the finer points of detail?
Yeah, so I mean, we were asking things like which disused RAF bases that Nigel Farage has claimed could be used to both house people who've been detained and then deport them. Would Reform use? We didn't get an answer to that. We asked, how far back would you go? So, for example, if you're somebody who arrived here as an illegal immigrant 10, 20 years ago, and you'd had a child who was born in the UK, would both of you be deported? And he suggested that that was a complex system. He didn't have all of the answers. So there was an effort to sort of put more meat on the bones of the policy, but there are still some big issues lacking.
And let's say Reform do win the next election. It is a big leap. I know, I appreciate they're ahead in the opinion polls, but this would be a colossal change in our politics were it to happen. Is he saying Absolutely. That on day one, anyone arriving on a small boat would be picked up on the beach, and whether they were man, woman or child, immediately put into one of these camps?
Yes, more or less. And the suggestion is that also it would apply retrospectively to people who are already here. I mean, we heard about how during the sort of first half of those 5 years, predominantly it would be adults, both men and women, who would be deported. But we also heard from Farage today that unaccompanied children who arrive as well would be deported as well in the sort of second half of that 5 year period. He put the number at roughly 600,000 people Reform is planning to remove over the next 5 years, which is a significant number. I mean, it's more than 10 times larger per year in terms of the number of people that are being deported currently.
And it would also mean potentially doing financial deals with the Taliban, with sending people back to an environment where if they were women, they'd have, well, barely a life of any kind. And if they were male, it wouldn't be much fun either. But that would happen, would it? They'd just be back in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan.
Absolutely. I mean, Nigel Farage suggested he was pretty comfortable with the idea that, say, dissidents or people who'd fled persecution from Afghanistan or Iran could be returned to face the wrath of the IRGC in Iran and the Taliban in Afghanistan. He did say that there would be a sort of limited exception for some Afghan interpreters who are small boat arrivals. But again, it's a bit hard on the one hand to say we're going to deport everybody who arrives here and then start seeming to make exceptions slightly on the cuff when he was asked by a journalist. And he was asked again, you know, are you going to be paying money to Afghanistan, to Iran, in order to facilitate these deals, to encourage these governments to take their people back at the risk of leading them to be tortured or possibly killed if they've fled the country? And again, he said the priority is about protecting British people, because he tried to cast illegal migration as a sort of criminal problem. He said basically what happens to those people when they go back to their own country is for that country to decide.
Thank you, Aubrey. That's Aubrey Allegretti, who's the Times chief political correspondent. Let's go to the Times' Emma Yeomans, because she has been spending time on the coast in Calais with people planning to make the trip to Britain.
We thought things were quietening down on Govelin's beach this morning, but there is now a third group of people emerging from the dunes and running towards the sea. This group have quite a number of children with them. We can see some being carried on shoulders, some young kids running ahead of their parents. There's still no fresh boats arriving, but one that we thought was departing is coming once again. And it may be that there is now another boat coming round the horizon. It is quite hard to tell what's going on here. There's a lot of shouting and there's now a small rib, which we believe is linked to a rescue ship, hovering off the coast as well. These rescue ships, they, while they don't intervene, they will come close to the small boats and make sure if the small boats get into trouble, people can be removed from the water quickly. I've also spoken just now to a man named Ali, who was also attempting to get on this boat. He gave his name as Ali and he comes from Iran. Ali made an application 2 weeks ago thereabouts, on the day the official forms opened for the scheme by which France and Britain can exchange migrants. This is the deal Keir Starmer struck with Emmanuel Macron, by which France will take back asylum seekers and migrants who have come to the UK illegally, and in exchange, up to 50 a week who have got a valid claim for protection in the UK can be transferred safely from France. The idea is to break the model of the people smugglers by showing people that they can be sent back and can and will be sent back to France if they enter the UK illegally, but that if they go through proper channels, they have a chance of coming to Britain. Ali made his application the day the scheme opened because he has family already settled with permanent residence living in Newcastle. He hopes to go join them, but after several weeks of hearing nothing, he says he believes that this scheme is not going to happen, that he will not be given a chance to come to the UK legally. So he is today attempting to board a small boat instead.
Well, there we are, just a slice of life from the coast in Calais. That was the Times' Emma Yeomans. Let's talk to Dr. Peter Walsh, who is senior researcher at the Migration Observatory. Dr. Walsh, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
First of all, should we or could we acknowledge that there is a big problem here? I understand that so far nearly 30,000 people have arrived in this country in small boats this year. This is a crisis, isn't it?
I think on both sides of the political fence, there's quite widespread agreement that small boat arrivals shouldn't be happening. They're dangerous. They do present a security risk in certain senses. So it is an issue, and it's one that the British public is increasingly exercised about, and which at least is partly responsible for pushing immigration to the top of the political agenda today in polling. It's not as big an issue as it was before Brexit, but it is trending upwards, and there's widespread agreement that more needs to be done to prevent this form of unauthorised migration.
I'm sure you saw some scenes from that speech this morning. What did you make of it?
The proposals are certainly very radical. In a certain sense, it was reminiscent of the Conservative Party's plans insofar as the policy was that anyone arriving without permission would be detained and deported, placing an obligation on the Home Secretary to do that. But there's also one big point of departure, which is that the Conservative government didn't suggest removing the UK from the Refugee Convention, which we helped to draft in 1951. And they did give regard to the principle of non-refoulement, not returning people to countries where they could be at risk of persecution. The intent, as laid out today by reform, seems to be quite different. And Nigel Farage really suggested that if people were to be returned to countries where they could be tortured and killed, that that is a price that they'd be willing to pay.
Do you think that ultimately, and to be really crude about it, their voters are perfectly happy with that? Their would-be voters, they don't care about these niceties. They just want this problem sorted and quickly.
It's difficult to know. I expect we'll have polling on this particular deportation plan. No doubt there will be a proportion of the population that will support it. But you'd expect there to be quite big divergences in opinion on party lines. There may be a certain section of the Conservative Party that also support this. By contrast, people who are more likely to vote Labour or Liberal may have strong opinions against it. It will be very interesting to see what the overall balance is across the whole of the UK population. But for sure, there will be a share, and not an insubstantial one, that will support this, because small boat arrivals are a contentious issue and they are rising to the top of the UK's political debate.
Would it be remotely feasible not just to deport people to countries like Iran or Afghanistan, but to places like Ascension Island? Could that really happen?
Ascension Island, you know, you'll recall this was previously on the cards. It's actually something that the Home Office looked into, and they essentially decided that it just wasn't financially viable because of the substantial investment it would require to develop infrastructure there, accommodation, sewerage, healthcare facilities and so on. That doesn't make it impossible. It just makes it extremely expensive. As for some of the countries from which people have fled, there are open questions about whether the Taliban would agree to take back their citizens, whether Iran would, a country that's currently under sanction by the UK. Each of those countries would have to be dealt with diplomatically on a one by one basis. And there are questions about that. But Reform have anticipated that, not just with Ascension Island, but with policies a la Rwanda, so safe third countries. They've mentioned Albania. Albania currently doesn't seem to have much appetite for hosting our asylum seekers. Whether Rwanda would be willing to go back to the negotiating table is an open question. It is really difficult to find countries to accept our asylum seekers.
I mean, there are complexities everywhere you look, aren't there? Iran is telling people to go back to Afghanistan. I understand that hundreds of thousands of people have been turfed out of Iran and sent back there. It's really hard to see how this could work in practice, although I think almost everybody listening acknowledges that there is an issue here that does need to be dealt with somehow.
It's an interesting case of Germany, which has returned, you know, around 100 Afghan nationals to Taliban-controlled Afghanistan. There is a question about whether negotiations with the UK are more complicated, given our history in the region. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but there's real uncertainty as to how that kind of agreement could be hammered out and whether it really is diplomatically feasible. The same with a number of the other countries. So there are real challenges and for the time being, open questions there about its practical feasibility, putting aside the whole raft of legislative activity that this would imply.
But just very briefly, will it do what it's supposed to? Will it deter those people that our reporter Emma was meeting on the coast at Calais from trying to get to the UK? If they think there's even a faint chance they might end up back in Eritrea or Afghanistan or on Ascension Island?
I expect that a similar logic may apply to the Rwanda scheme, to the France-UK returns deal, in just how many people are able to be removed. If a sufficiently large share are removed, and there's a sufficiently high chance that people who want to reach the UK will fail in their endeavour to do so, then it could materialise a large deterrent effect, but it does depend on those numbers.
Thank you very much. That's Dr. Peter Walsh, who's from the Migration Observatory. Now, the most read stories on the Times website so far today, number 3, save the state pension by taking it away from the under 75s. I know, a national intake of breath. We can hear it. Pensions expert Tom McPhail on a radical new approach. The second most read story is Nigel Farage, exactly what Jane was talking about there. That is the live page today. Give it a read for all of the political updates you need. But the most read piece on the Times website is why the Princess of Wales has gone blonde. It's very important stuff. I put it to you that actually it's something of a trick of the light. If, like me, she's dyeing her hair, you get to a stage where actually if you shine light on your hair because there's no proper kind of colour within it left, it always looks a little bit orangey blonde. And right. I think this misfortune has come upon her too. I just put it to you. It's the only thing we have in common. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You'll need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. You can go to thetimes.com/subscribe. We're going to talk big cats in a moment. If you've seen one, we'd like a description. If you've got a picture, that's even better. You're listening to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio.
Global events.
The war has triggered an energy crisis, of course, all across Europe.
Reactive analysis.
Well, let's turn now to the MP behind that amendment.
Breaking news.
We're keeping an eye on the Middle East as ever, where Israel continues to face pressure from all sides.
There's this question about where the money will come from.
From the world's best journalists.
Time now to invite you to our briefing room and talk to one of our leading strategic experts.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are one Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
Mm.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me?
You've got it. Hmm. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, we've been talking about big cat sightings on Off Air, the podcast. It's where all the important things in life are covered. And who isn't intrigued by the notion that there are huge panthers or leopards padding their way around our countryside, hiding in the hedgerows, just waiting for a week in the silly season of summer when Jeremy Clarkson is away on holiday and they can get the countryside news coverage they deserve. Rick Minter is the leading expert on these sightings. He's got a podcast of his own called Big Cat Conversations.
It was obvious it was a big black cat, and it was in a hunting position, a striking position. He clearly knew we were up.
I go to bed at night and think about it. Is she all right? Is someone trying to hunt her?
Welcome to Big Cat Conversations. We speak directly to people who've encountered one of Britain's big cats. We also discuss the bigger picture. I'm Rick Minter, and thanks for joining me.
Well, Rick Minter, thanks for joining us. Very good afternoon. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to have a chat about it.
Well, it's absolutely our pleasure. First of all, is there any doubt that big cats do exist in our countryside?
Well, we have DNA evidence now which backs up the claims that they match, that most of the descriptions match the leopard in its black form. There are a few snippets of videos and footage. Often people are reluctant to release those because of the sensitivity on their neighbouring land. And it's routinely reported. There are 40 species of wild cats in the world of different shapes and sizes. And we get three routinely reported in Britain, mainly about sort of 80%, give or take, the leopard in its black form. And they breed on black, so even the sort of anecdotal sightings are very consistent, and people don't know these cats, but they describe them very well.
When we say big cats, how big are they?
I think the key definition is it big enough to take down a deer, to stalk, ambush and predate and consume an adult roe deer, even a red deer in Scotland. So, that, you know, it's not a big feral cat. You can get big feral cats that are, you know, a third bigger than a normal domestic cat, which look very wild. And I think a few of the sightings are those. So we're very careful about scaling and very tough on the evidence. And we often say we're not sure about what somebody claims or we don't think they're correct. But I think the majority of these reports are very credible and consistent and are indeed, you know, reporting these very large cats.
Are the sightings reported to you then logged somewhere official?
No, they're not. There are different systems of logging them. And because of the ongoing interest at Royal Agricultural University, we may get student input to that. There are a couple of very good big cat sightings, Facebook groups, where that's they're independently logged and mapped. A very good system in the Scotland Facebook group. And the historical dates are there, so you can see the consistency. Sometimes there may be coincidental sightings from past years with a current sighting. Sometimes it may suggest an ongoing persistent sort of breeding episode in that sort of in that area. So it's very tricky to get a handle on it because the situation is very DIY. It's a very DIY subject, very dispersed. But a lot of the good investigators keep together and swap notes so that we got a handle on what's going on.
So, Rick, they must be mating for continued sightings to be happening. But if they are mating, why aren't there more of them?
Well, they might not be able to breed optimally. There clearly aren't very many in a place like Britain where they're still establishing themselves. And if a mother only has a litter of between one and three or four, for example, and one doesn't make it, and she certainly only have a litter of, say, one in her perhaps her last two litters, so she might only have three or four litters in her lifetime. So they're not going to breed like Topsy. I mean, herbivores, you know, deer, obviously, and rabbits, obviously, really do have many generations of breeding, and so the populations do expand. Alpha predators sort of regulate and don't breed optimally like other mammals.
So our numbers will always stay low then?
Yes, but and of course we don't know what we're. A lot of the reports and sightings we think never get anywhere. I will take sightings at events and people will come to me and say, like a rural agricultural show where I set up a stand and it's very much about awareness raising and swapping notes. And most of those people who make reports in a day will say, I've never told anybody about this, and now I've got the situation where it's relevant. And so people are very reticent about reporting, and sometimes they do report a mother and cubs, and they can find it very emotional, very sensitive. We have a few on the podcast, and you can see how credible you can hear how credible those reports are.
I mean, you're absolutely right, Rick. It's one of those things where quite often when people tell you that they've seen a big cat or you hear some kind of story, our go-to position is that's apocryphal and they're a little bit bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, I know this from my own family. When I started to dabble in the subject years ago, my father, every time, he found it beyond his comfort zone, like a lot of people do. He found it too weird to go there. He wasn't doubtful. He just found it was an awkward subject, and he didn't want his son dabbling in it. He kept on saying, you will damage your reputation if you keep going onto this subject. But I wrote a book, and that opened doors, and I've continued to open doors and get trust with people and been seen as somebody responsible, hopefully, and that's why I do get information. But I'm sure many people will not relay information to me because it is just too awkward and difficult for them if they're an estate owner. And I go to places like care homes with land where the maintenance guy has seen one on the land in the furthest, you know, wildest part of the sort of 6-acre garden and has seen eviscerated deer kills on the land. So I keep people's secrets, and many landowners, even nature reserve managers, will keep it quiet and not tell their head office of their organisation. So, and police officers. So it's a very sort of DIY, under the radar subject. Everybody gets that it's awkward and it's difficult to admit it for full. But I'm the fall guy. I don't mind being the fall guy. And at least I do relay what we can on podcasts. And not everybody wants to come on the podcast as well. We miss some very interesting and dramatic encounters on the podcast because people are wary.
James has WhatsApp to say, I saw a large black panther in Berkshire about 25 years ago. No one believed me. So there we go. There's an illustration. Are big cats the kind of UFOs of 2025, Rick? Because people used to see UFOs quite a lot. You don't get so many of those reports anymore. But big cats and conspiracy theories appear to have taken over. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's one of these things where if it starts trending in the media, people pick it up, and one thing leads to another, which is probably why you sort of noticed it. The most recent sort of trend happened because one of my older episodes of a panther seen stalking a fox, and the dogs rumbling the panther, and the fox coming out of its corner position and following the lady and her dogs home for safe escort, and that was on the edge of Tetbury, which is near Highgrove, and the press put Highgrove together with that report and the royals being stalked by big cats. And that sort of trended, and so obviously I benefited from that because I've had a lot of reports from that, because people seeing me and seeing my website, sending me old reports, like old emails, just like you've had that guy, but you always need to then follow them up. But yeah. I think it's probably like UFOs or any other unorthodox subjects. If you scratch the surface, there's a lot of people waiting to be asked.
Are there areas of the country that get more sightings than others? Does it tend to be around Clare Balding's Ramblings, which you've been on, I think, Rick, haven't you?
Yeah, in a way, got to be careful about this issue about where are the most popular locations. In biology, there's a concept called the recorder effect. When you're sampling something, whether it's a plant or an animal or whatever, where there are more active investigators, reporters, recipients of the information who can log the reports, there often is more of that object you're trying to identify, that species you're trying to identify. So maybe there's more in Gloucestershire, more reports in Gloucestershire and around, because I'm here with other people and we're trusted and we're known about. And some of the black holes are places which are not so busy with big cat reports. There aren't so many active known investigators. So we'll never know. But what I can say is that they are consistently described across all parts of Britain, Scotland, England and Wales.
Well, it's so good to talk to you, Rick. Thank you very much indeed. It's such a fascinating area of work. If you want to listen to Rick Minter's podcast, it's called Big Cat Conversations.
And thanks to Nicole. She says, what about the Beast of Bodmin Moor? Apparently a family of black panthers.
says Nicole. Thank you for that. Keep your thoughts coming. We're very late to the news headlines, but we just need to say that coming very soon on Times Radio, we've got a big interview with Alex McBride talking about the courtroom series The Jury. And we'll also be talking to the authors of a book called Unmasking Lucy Letby. They are BBC journalists, and I think it's fair to say this is a very careful book. I'm just going to quote from it very briefly. It's unclear she's definitely guilty and far from clear she's innocent. So this is, to put it mildly, a complicated area. We'll talk about that after 3 o'clock. It's Times Radio. Here are the headlines. Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Nigel Farage has warned of a genuine threat to public order without action to tackle illegal migration. The Reform UK leader has presented plans he calls Operation Restoring Justice. They'd see those illegally crossing the Channel, including women and children, deported if his party is elected to government. Labour have called the proposals an unworkable gimmick. Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch says Mr Farage's plans look familiar.
Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. The fact is Nigel Farage is copying our homework. We put out a deportation bill in May. The stuff that actually works and what he said has come from there. But the truth is, he is not doing the thinking. We are.
The owner of a hotel in Essex, which has been told to stop housing migrants, will have its appeal against the decision heard on Thursday. The Bell in Epping was the centre of protest before a temporary injunction was granted. The family of one of the victims killed in a helicopter crash on the Isle of Wight are appealing to help bring her body home to Poland. Justyna Choska and Wojciech Kowalkowski died when the helicopter came down near Shanklin yesterday. A court has heard Poundland will run out of money within days if a restructuring plan isn't approved. The company is asking a judge to sign off on a scheme to stop it entering administration. And the Duchess of Sussex has revealed she felt not well after spending nearly 3 weeks away from her children. The second series of her Netflix show With Love, Meghan has just dropped, in which she also reveals radio is the thing she misses most about the UK. And for news when you want it, subscribe to our podcast, The Times News Briefing and The World in 10.
This is Times Radio.
Your eyes first met from across the ballroom. He is noble, but he acts with such kindness. You waited in the stables, ready to elope. And all the while, you were completing the spreadsheets. There's more to imagine when you listen. Get lost in timeless romance titles on Audible, like Brothers by Russell Tovey. Subscription required. See audible.co.uk for terms.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.75% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that countryside getaway with the family. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.65% gross. Terms apply.
Fly direct to Texas and embark on a truly epic road trip adventure, because there's no place on earth like the Lone Star State. Explore miles of music, food, and culture from hill country to the Panhandle Plains. Experience cowboy grit, heritage, legendary hospitality, and those unbeatable cinematic sunsets in the great outdoors. Drive and discover your Texan road adventure at TexasFrontiers.com. Expand your frontiers.
Get the day's politics, business, and sport every weekday in Breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
John Pienaar is here with news of his programme between 4 o'clock and 7. John.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Reform UK plans for asylum seekers, it's not just interesting, it's a really important debate, this, isn't it? It will tell us something about what sort of country and what sort of a people we are now. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when the idea of deportations to Rwanda was first mentioned, and it seemed then almost comical, and an idea from a Whitehall farce, the idea of sending asylum seekers to Rwanda. And now the idea of using Rwanda almost seems like a moderate alternative to some of the ideas that are being floated. And, you know, the big question is, will obviously Britain won't, but will a lot of Britain take to an idea like this? So I'm going to be talking to, well, Amnesty International. I think we can guess where they're going to come in on this, but it's good, it'll be useful to get that perspective. Roger Boyce, the world editor at the Times, on the idea of sending deportees to Afghanistan, even if there's a deal, even if there's some sort of returns deal, if there is a promise, and one kind of imagines there would have to be, not to mistreat, let alone execute asylum seekers.
Couldn't trust them.
Could you believe it? And so Roger Boyce is going to be with us, and I'll ask him that question. Number 10 Downing Street, by the way, after the Reform UK experience, so they were, everything was on the table. They didn't rule out the idea of a deal with Afghanistan, which is maybe, if nothing else, and it's an indication of Keir Starmer and his team being constantly pushed onto the back foot and being careful about moving on to the front one. I'm also talking about Donald Trump and the possible charges against that member of the Federal Reserve Board. Is this part of a political persecution? Joe Walsh, who's a former Republican, who's now not one, wonder what he says. And in my regular unlocking AI slot, I'm going to be talking about AI. Is it something really to be scared of? It's a variation on a theme which we hit very often, but it's worth hitting often.
Just to say, actually, on the AI tip, we've got Nick Clegg coming on the programme next Wednesday. He's got a book out which is all about the crossroads we're at the moment regarding AI.
That'd be so interesting.
Won't it just? Yeah. If he can't answer the questions, maybe we'll just get on a chatbot instead. Well, actually, we're also talking about chatbots, aren't we, in the health news this afternoon? So we've got everything covered. John, thank you very much. John will be your guide to the late afternoon and evening here on Times Radio. He starts at 4 o'clock. Now, the safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, has admitted that the main tool used to decide which domestic abuse victims get urgent support doesn't really work. Now, across the UK, police, social services and healthcare workers have largely relied on a questionnaire. I'm holding a copy of it now. It's known as DASH, and it's designed to assess if people are at risk. It is the Domestic Abuse, Stalking and Harassment and Honour-Based Violence Risk Identification and Assessment and Management Model. Now, Jess Phillips' remit covers violence against women and girls, and she says that until it can be replaced, this questionnaire, with something that actually works, we'll just have to make the best of the system that we have. Well, Dr. Heather Strang is director of the Jerry Lee Centre for Experimental Criminology at the University of Cambridge. Dr. Strang, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
I must admit, slightly baffled by this questionnaire. Can you just explain to us the circumstances in which it would be used?
The DASH form is used in almost every instance of police attending domestic abuse incidents. It's a questionnaire put to the victim in the case or the complainant, and it's meant to elicit information that will provide some guidance on the likelihood of future harm in that relationship.
So the victim or alleged victim sits with a police officer and together they work their way through this form?
Exactly. It takes around an hour and a half. It's quite resource intensive to complete the form.
Yes. I mean, it starts off with the very simple question, has the current event resulted in injury? This one assumes is a reference to the incident that has meant that the police have been called. And the second question is, are you very frightened? And then it goes on. There are other questions about, is the abuse getting worse? Are you currently pregnant? I have to say, this is a practical thing, that there isn't much space on this bit of paper. Where are you supposed to put all the details?
Well, that's one of many practical difficulties with the form. Of course, the police are, in fact, summarising, just putting a précis of what they hear from the victim on the form. The tragedy is that the information elicited is not used in any meaningful way. At the end of the process, the police officer simply adds up a score based on the answers to these questions, which are mostly yes or no, and on that basis assigns a high standard or low risk to that particular victim's circumstances.
And the police officer who is helping the victim to fill in the form, they would be specially trained, would they, or just the person who answered the call?
It's the person assigned by the force to attend the call.
But all police officers would have had training in using the dash form.
I can't comment on that.
Right. Well, I mean, potentially that's concerning if somebody is attempting to use it for the first time. I have to say, I mean, it is lengthy and it's quite complicated and it requires immense sensitivity. And quite honestly, I would think you would require a really high level of training to be able to use this correctly.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with you, but there's a more fundamental problem with it, which is that it's used as a risk assessment tool and has been shown not to do that job very well. So no matter how well you administer the questionnaire, the reality is that you're not being able to draw out of it the information that's needed to make a reliable assessment of future harm. Yeah.
Well, you're quite right to make it clear that this should be about the practical impact of filling in this form. Let's say I do fill in the form. I am the victim. I have a very helpful police officer and I tell them that, quite honestly, I'm scared to death. I am being violently abused and I need help immediately. What will happen?
Well, I don't know, because it depends on your answers to all 27 questions. And then,
well, I mean, in my nightmare scenario, I have made it clear in all my answers that I am extremely vulnerable and I am terrified. Right. So what happens now?
Well, your risk is assigned to the high risk basket, and that will mean that you're, depending on where you live and the services available, that you will be put in touch with services designed to assist and support you.
Will I be immediately removed from the home?
Well, no, that's really not the responsibility of the police officer to remove you from the home. You can certainly discuss with the police officer options for moving elsewhere, and they may even facilitate your move, but that's really beyond police responsibility to remove you.
But this form will only be used when the alleged perpetrator has been taken away.
Well, in the vast majority of cases, the perpetrator is not any longer present by the time the police arrive. If they are, then, of course, the police make judgment about whether they should be arrested. But that is, in a sense, a separate procedure from assessing the future risk of harm to the victim. I think what we need to discuss here really is the best way of making that risk assessment. And I don't think many people these days disagree that DASH doesn't do a good job on that. Indeed, the College of Policing has developed an alternative questionnaire, fewer questions, but some would say more relevant, which has been shown to certainly be better at identifying coercive control in the relationship, which is really not addressed at all in DASH. But the limited evaluations that have been carried out on this alternative indicate that overall it's not really any better than DASH. So what we really need to talk about is other ways of assessing that risk, so that out of the hundreds of thousands of cases of victims who call the police every year, in what realistic way can the police decide who is most in need of the help that is available? And I think that we need to be thinking much more creatively about that.
Do you have any ideas?
And asking. Yes, I do. I think that instead of volume, that is the number of repeat calls being the principal metric that is used in assigning risk, we should really be looking at harm. Now, victims call police all the time and talk about the harm they've experienced. That is very valuable information to the police in deciding which perpetrators really require their priority attention. So that, for example, the Metropolitan Police in London are using something called the VOG 100, that is the Violence Against Women and Girls 100 most harmful perpetrators, based on the information that they already hold that victims have supplied to them about past behaviour. And the Met has identified 100 people out of around 35,000 calls last year involving 35,000 perpetrators. Mm-hmm. And those 100 are really prioritised. So I think that what we should be doing is thinking about the most harmful people and targeting them, rather than relying on very inadequate indicators of the kind that Dash and Dara are providing in identifying where scarce resources should be assigned.
Yes, I wish we had more time to explore that further, but thank you very much for your thoughts. That's Dr. Heather Strang of the University of Cambridge.
I'm going to make a stunning gear change. Come with me on this one. Margaret says, my husband and dog were terrorised by a very wild big cat last week. It was a giant ginger Tom that followed them down the street, hissing and spitting. Does that count as a big cat sighting? It was very big. And it was very wild. Yes, Margaret, we'll give that one to you. Would you be fine with your children speaking to an AI therapist chatbot? That is in our health news. We'll talk about that next. You're listening to Jane and Fee here on Times Radio.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Wow, Direct Line sorted my claim with a 5-year guarantee on the car repairs. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like getting my kids to eat their greens.
Mummy, the vegetable van is here. Please can I have a broccoli pop? Or a courgette? Please?
Go on then.
Direct Line, that's how it's done.
Valid whilst the car is yours. Must use approved repairers. Excludes poor maintenance, later damage, wear and tear.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. Mm. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Societies Rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
So we always do health stories on a Tuesday afternoon. We're going to talk about AI chatbots specifically aimed at children in a couple of moments' time. But let's start by talking about Wes Streeting's announcement today, saying that the pharmaceutical industry is making unaffordable demands and that talks between the government and drug firms have broken down. Dr. Rachel Ward is a GP, co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast and our resident doctor. Rachel, can you just explain what that means for patients?
Good afternoon. Yeah, so drug pricing is a very, very complex situation in the UK and of course around the world, but there are different rules wherever you are. So there has been negotiations ongoing. There were some agreements on drug pricing set in 2023. And this was around a system called with something called a clawback tax. And basically, this kind of led to a control over NHS spending on drugs. And it meant that if the NHS spent beyond a threshold on a certain named drug, then the pharmaceutical company had to pay some of the additional cost back. What the companies are saying is that this has been significantly more expensive than they expected, but there is some tie into this until 2028. Now, the situation gets even more complicated because essentially, Keir Starmer has set a situation where he's saying that he wants the UK to be the leading life science economy by 2030. But what the pharma companies are saying is that the way things are set up in the UK at the moment, with NICE approving which drugs are used, that is not going to happen. So at the moment, NICE have a threshold for £20,000 to £30,000 per year of healthy life that they will spend on a drug, which is considered actually very low compared to other countries and hasn't changed in the UK for the last 25 years. What drug companies are saying now, this is almost really making it impossible to really invest and, champion the UK as a place where new drugs should be trialled and ultimately new drugs becoming available to our patients. So, sorry, that is a very convoluted explanation. It's a very complex issue, drug pricing. But I think the bottom line here is that there's concern that we will be missing out on opportunities to have new therapies, new drugs, and we're just falling behind other countries.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is complicated, but thank you for explaining it, because I think we, at the point of issue of drugs, don't understand exactly that kind of hinterland that has gone on before the drugs ever reach us. Another thing that we wanted to talk about was some very unexpected side effects of a certain type of drugs. We have covered this story before, but the topic has re-emerged on our podcast, and it's patients who've been prescribed drugs for movement disorders like Parkinson's and restless leg syndrome who don't seem to have been made aware that the drug can have side effects, including risky sexual behaviours and compulsive gambling, with actually some dreadful stories of the consequences of those things, Rachel. How can drugs affect you that way?
Yeah, so these drugs, these are dopamine agonists. So as you say, generally used most commonly, I'd say, for Parkinson's. They can be used for other things like restless leg syndrome, but ultimately they are having a huge impact on the signalling in your brain. And dopamine is one of our transmitters in our brain. And therefore, when you are changing those levels, it can, on occasion, have an impact on how we think and how we behave. So these drugs really are very significant. Of course, they have very, very beneficial outcomes for many patients. But there have been cases reported. I think the BBC have had about 50 cases reported of really serious side effects. This has been described as impulse control disorder. And as you say, it's where people can have an absolute change in kind of disinhibited sexual behavior, seeking inappropriate things, gambling, impulsive behavior. And it is believed that this has been known about for some time as a potential side effect. But the concern of many people is this has not been appropriately communicated to patients and the warnings have been inadequate.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, though, isn't it, Rachel? Because so many of the things that you described, there's an element of shame about suddenly behaving in that kind of way. And you can see why perhaps this hasn't got the attention it deserves, because people simply don't want to go around saying, you'll never guess what happened to me when I started taking this drug.
Absolutely. And also people understandably don't put two and two together and think, well, I've been given this drug for my Parkinson's, but now I've got this really risky sexual behaviour. I mean, that just doesn't, understandably, people are not going to think they are linked.
Yeah.
So I think, I suspect it is a very underreported issue, as you say.
I'm sure we will return to it. We wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about these bots, Rachel, offering mental health support to children on social media. Now, there are some really severe warnings about this. This is children who might turn to an AI chatbot who seem friendly. They chat back to you. They can appear very human. I've said who, and it should actually be what. But this is AI. It's a computer. It's an algorithm. It's not going to care for the child.
Absolutely. And the concern is that this is appearing on social media platforms. So my understanding that Meta, who obviously own Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, they are being investigated in the US at the moment over allegations of deceptive AI generated mental health services. And as you say, the concern is that this is not differentiated as an AI bot compared to an actual health professional. And it's something which, of course, is available 24/7. You know, the child might be looking at something and they are interacting late at night when, you know, actually that's not what they need to be doing. The responses are not in a, you know, controlled and not regulated in the same way as a health professional. And the safety netting that you would also get in a health setting is not there. And some counsellors from the British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy have come forward and said that they are seeing children that are using these and having really negative outcomes. And they are very concerned about it. Yeah. You know, it's something that I, to be honest, wasn't really aware even existed. No. So it is really important for parents to know.
Absolutely. So we will continue talking about it, but it's the latest in a seemingly unending line, Rachel, of problems that are identified when people start to suffer at the hands of these large tech companies and the technology they've created. The point at which they could decide this is a harmful product was way back when. You don't have to wait until a kid has logged on to an AI-generated mental health therapist to work out that that might not be the right way forward for them. You could have thought that's not a good product to put out there in the first place. That is my rant for the day. Don't worry, everybody, it's over now. Rachel, it's lovely to talk to you. It always is. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Rachel Ward. Her podcast is called The Pharmacy Podcast. That is Pharmacy, in case you'd like a little bit more of Dr. Ward, a little bit less of me. I'm sorry, I really went off on one.
Sophie says, that drug conversation with the doctor sounds remarkably like the plot of the Netflix drama Hostage.
There was some risky behaviour.
Yeah. Oh, I know, I definitely thought that. But Hostage is causing a little bit of, well, we talk about it on the podcast, let's put it that way.
You like it?
I'm watching it.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
I think it's fair to say that Hostage is what? Cast, rich, plot, quite poor.
Yes, and a little bit script anemic.
Okay. 3 o'clock, it's Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. In the next hour, protests in Israel calling for a deal to release the remaining hostages. And we talk to the authors of Unmasking Lucy Letby, Jonathan Coffey and Judith Moritz. The Times has called their book meticulous and unexpectedly gripping. You can hear from them a little bit later. And our big interview is with Alex McBride, talking about season 2 of the courtroom series, The Jury. Here's the news at 3, Times Radio, Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Downing Street has said the Prime Minister is angry with the language used by Nigel Farage with his immigration plans. If Reform UK wins the next election, he's promised to deport small boats arrivals, including women and children, at an estimated cost of £10 billion over 5 years. Mr Farage claims without action, there's a genuine threat to public order. Steve Smith is the manager of the Care for Calais charity.
75% of them are young men. Well, actually, that makes 25% of them women and children. What is going to happen to them? What happens about unaccompanied minors? Are they going to be deported? And deported where? How?
The Conservatives, meanwhile, have accused Nigel Farage of copying their homework. Families of Israeli hostages in Gaza have taken part in large demonstrations, pressing their government to make a deal with Hamas to release hostages and end the war. It comes amid international anger over the deaths of medical workers and journalists in a double strike on a hospital in Gaza yesterday. Political analyst Ari Kovler is in Jerusalem.
The mainstream media channels have covered this as a very serious incident, as something that shouldn't have happened. And we haven't seen, as we've seen at other points throughout this war, the kind of mainstream Israeli media rallying around the government narrative, but rather saying this is really bad.
A major manhunt is underway in the Australian state of Victoria after a man is alleged to have shot dead two police officers. He's now taken his family hostage and fled into bushland after the incident in a small town 4 hours from Melbourne. The family of one of the victims killed in a helicopter crash on the Isle of Wight are appealing to help bring her body home to Poland. Justyna Choska and Wojciech Kowalkowski died when the helicopter came down in Shanklin yesterday. An announcement is expected that energy bills are going up in October. The regulator is updating its price cap tomorrow, which sets a limit on what companies can charge customers per unit of gas and electricity. Forecasters think the typical bill will rise by around £17 because of rising tensions in the Middle East. And the latest series of the Duchess of Sussex's Netflix programme has been released. 8 episodes of the show, With Love, Meghan, shares some of her home life. The Times' royal editor, Kate Mansey, has been watching.
It's a lot less about her. She doesn't talk about the royal family at all. Seem to have put that in the past. You know, there's no criticism there or anything kind of juicy in that respect. But she does say she misses one thing from the UK. Sadly, it's not Times Radio. It's Magic FM. She likes the nostalgic pop music, apparently.
And for news when you want it, subscribe to our podcast, The Times News Briefing and The World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app and via your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. On Times Radio.
It is Jane and Fee with you until 4 o'clock, and then John Pienaar takes over. We're going to talk about the Lucy Letby case in a couple of moments' time. And also after 3:30, a new series of The Jury on Channel 4, which really puts the focus on whether or not the jury service is fit for purpose in terms of the verdicts and acquittals that it might be giving. And it's very thought-provoking stuff. If you've any experience yourself of being in a jury room, we would love to hear your thoughts about whether or not you think the right place was reached. First, though, protests are happening across Israel today calling for a ceasefire deal to secure the release of the hostages held in Gaza. 251 hostages were taken when Hamas attacked on October the 7th, 2023. Of those still being held, 20 are believed to still be alive. Now, the demonstrations come a day after an Israeli strike reportedly killed at least 20 people, including 5 journalists, at a large hospital in Gaza. We can talk about all of this with our reporter in Tel Aviv, Shosh Bedrosian. A very good afternoon from us in London. Can you paint a picture of these protests for us, where they're taking place, Shosh, and how many people have joined in?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So the protests mark the second nationwide strikes that have taken place this month alone in the month of August. This morning, they started around 6:30 a.m., which is symbolic because that's the exact time the October 7th massacre happened back in 2023. Between 6:30 a.m. and 10 a.m., thousands of protesters went to the junctions of major intersections across the country of Israel, flocking there and protesting for the release of the hostages, supporting these families who have been fighting for their loved ones to come home for about 690 days at this point in time, blocking traffic across major highways. Actually, right now, it's being reported that there are major highways across central Israel being blocked, specifically in between major cities like Jerusalem and in Tel Aviv, with traffic actually standing still in several locations. We're expecting a massive protest to take place in Hostages Square tonight. And we've seen this in the last nationwide strike that happened just a few weeks ago, where 600,000 people at the last rally of the day came out in Tel Aviv.
So with regard to that last protest, which was the biggest seen so far until today, it didn't move the dial, though, did it, politically, in terms of the Netanyahu approach to the hostages and Gaza? Would that be fair to say?
I think I differ on that statement. I'll tell you why. After that protest, we know that Prime Minister actually instructed a team to start negotiating a different type of deal, a comprehensive deal, a deal that would get all 50 hostages back. Right now, we know that there's a partial deal that's on the table right now. And it's a deal that Hamas actually pushed away back in July. So U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff's proposal that sought for a 60-day ceasefire in exchange for 10 living hostages, 18 dead hostages, in exchange for dozens of Palestinian prisoners. But Hamas came back to the table after we know there's been military pressure, specifically on Israel wanting to expand in Gaza City. But after these protests, we know that Netanyahu is like he made a statement on it just last week. He instructed negotiators to start working on a comprehensive deal. So that's what has come out of that. Let's see what comes out, though, tonight with these protests and see, you know, the messaging from the families, seeing who will be speaking at the major protests that will be taking place tonight. We know that families of these hostages usually speak, but also released hostages who have been able to talk about the conditions that they were held in Hamas captivity. And like I said earlier, if I didn't, 20 living hostages are believed to be still in Gaza at this point in time.
How much of the protest is also calling for a ceasefire in Gaza?
I think calling for a hostage deal also calls for a ceasefire, because that's what we've seen in the past deals. Every time there was a deal, there was a pause in fighting that came with it. So back in between the months of January through March, there was a ceasefire in place with these hostages that were released. And so there wasn't fighting that happened. But, you know, these hostages did manage to come out, many of them in groups. I don't think Israeli society thought this would go on for this long. You know, thinking about these hostages that are alive, what conditions they could possibly be in. I want your audience to know that the family of one of the living hostages, Nimrod Cohen, who was kidnapped on October 7th as a soldier from his tank, his family decided last night to release the video that the IDF obtained of his kidnapping on that horrific day. He was taken from his tank. He was one of the only soldiers to live and survive that moment from his tank. And he was seen, you know, arm in arm with these terrorists that forced him into Gaza. Those were his last moments seen alive on camera. So, of course, the families here wanting to make sure that the public and the government continues to see what they're fighting for.
Do you believe that this will move things on at all? Netanyahu is not in a totally secure position politically, but actually there just never seems to be any real movement. I take on board what you've told us about Hamas being more willing to come to the table over a different deal on the hostages. But, Josh, you know, we've been reporting over the last 24 hours about 20 more people killed, the Israeli strike on a hospital in Gaza, 5 journalists dead too. It is hard to see that a progress towards any kind of peace is being made.
Yeah, I think the devastation and the tragedy of lives being lost in Gaza is seen by everyone in Israel, and the desperation of food is also seen by many people in Israel as well. Just the center focus, though, and the reason why, you know, this war, as many people believe, is still so much ongoing is because these hostages are still there. You know, there's a statement and a sentence everyone here in Israel continues to say: if Hamas wanted to end this war, they would give the hostages back. And at this point in time, for people to know that there are 20 people being starved to death, you know, we all saw that horrific video Hamas released of Aviatar David just a few weeks ago, of his gaunt condition. That's the focus for so many Israelis, of getting these lives back. You know, it's part of it's a Jewish backbone and a Jewish practice of preserving life. And that's the value the Israeli people stand on.
Sure. I fully understand all of this. And I don't want my next question to seem insensitive with regard to everything that you've just said. But Shosh, if there was more protest from Israelis about the treatment of Gazans, you know, there is a worldwide abhorrence about the starvation, particularly of children within Gaza at the moment. Are you saying that doesn't come into the protest and shouldn't come into the protest? There is no wish for that to be within a protest?
No, I think that there's a spectrum of people that come out to the protest who also protest for a ceasefire to end the suffering in Gaza, who want to end the suffering of the hostages. I think that, you know, Israel is a democratic country. People come out in all different forms with all different values. And that's the really interesting part about reporting on the ground here is when you go to Hostages Square, you meet people who come from all different walks of life and want to see the war ending for, you know, for pretty much all the reasons that, you know, you just listed, that either it's hunger in Gaza, whether it's, you know, airstrikes in Gaza and the military action, but also, you know, as I continue to say, the hostages that are suffering and these families that are completely torn apart. So I think that there's a spectrum, and I don't think there's any right answer to that question. I think Israel has so many diverse people who are protesting for different reasons here.
The next elections in Israel wouldn't be until October, correct?
Correct.
Do you think that you will be in a different position in Israel if something doesn't happen over the next coming weeks in Gaza in order to try and bring the hostages home? I mean, it's interesting if we all try and cast our mind back to a more peaceful time before the dreadful events of October 2023. The political position of Benjamin Netanyahu was not secure then, was it? There were challenges over other aspects of his Likud government. So what do you think politically does happen over the coming months?
I think that's a good question. And I don't know if that's a question I can even answer or anyone in Israel can answer, because every single day it's changing. For us as journalists, we're constantly covering different things. It's hard to see what will happen politically, even within the next 2 months, because remember, in mid-September, there's plans approved to go into Gaza City. So I think it's kind of all eyes are on that and how that operation goes into effect. And you know, there's going to be about 60,000 reservists who are getting called up in this. What will this do to Israeli society? Will Israeli society be in a completely different place, even looking at the political spectrum? So I think it's a matter of a waiting game, as it always is in Israel, to see how these events shape out.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us today. That's Shosh Bedrosian joining us from Tel Aviv. It takes us to 15 minutes past three.
Good afternoon. It is Times Radio, and we are going to talk now about the paperback edition of the book Unmasking Lucy Letby. It has been updated for the paperback version. It's by the BBC journalists Jonathan Coffey and Judith Moritz. I'm sure you know, but it's just worth reminding everybody that Lucy Letby was found guilty of the murders of seven babies and the attempted murders of seven others. She's serving life in prison and she will never be released. Jonathan and Judith, thank you both very much for coming on the programme. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Can we just start, if you don't mind, Jonathan, by just acknowledging where we are now? And this is such a complicated picture, and there are parallel universes. We've got, first of all, at the heart of the book, and it certainly should be uppermost in our thoughts this afternoon, the bereaved families who are still having an absolutely wretched time. And we absolutely want to say that there's no way that you've forgotten them in the book, and nor have you forgotten them in the documentaries you've made. But alongside them, we've got the campaigners who believe this woman is innocent. Then there are some people who aren't certain, but believe that she isn't guilty beyond reasonable doubt. There's also the possibility that she might be charged with more crimes. And then there's the Thirlwell inquiry on how she committed the crimes, which we'll report next year. It really is a very complex web, this, isn't it, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think you've captured it perfectly there. And I think, you know, we use the term parallel universes. You could say two different realities, two different truths. And the people operating within those universes are absolutely convinced of their positions. And it makes it very difficult, I think, for people who are outside of those universes, who are looking in, who maybe aren't very familiar with the story, to figure out what is going on, who do we believe, what is true and what is false. And I think with this book, we have tried our level best to be ruthlessly objective and present readers with a way of understanding this story and understanding how these two parallel universes relate to each other to the extent that they do.
Judith, you are, I think, one of the very few people to sit through every day of Lucy Letby's trials. That's correct, isn't it?
Not every day, but most. I certainly was there throughout for 10 months, very regularly at court for 10 months of the first trial, throughout her retrial and throughout the Thirlwall inquiry. You just talked there about all of these different, well, as Jonathan captured it there, the parallel universes, all of these different legal proceedings that have been rolling over the last few years. And actually, my involvement in the story goes back to 2017, pretty much, which was the first time that we got any inkling of anything going on before the name Lucy Letby was out there publicly. The very first time that this story emerged, as journalists, we went down to the hospital because we had heard that there was going to be a police investigation into a rise in the number of deaths on the neonatal unit there. And then since then, you know, 2018 was the first time that Lucy Letby's name emerged when she was arrested. And it's been an absolute labyrinth since that point. So yeah, being in court was really critical for me. I was in the courtroom. There were only four journalists who were in the room itself in the courtroom, as opposed to watching on video at a distance. And that gave us the ability, I think, to look at that trial in the round as we experienced it, as closely, I suppose, as the jury experienced it, sitting there watching all of the witnesses, watching Lucy Letby herself in the dock, and watching and listening to her giving evidence, which was a really critical moment, I think, during the trial itself. And it's definitely informed our approach to the story, my approach to the story. Since then, it's become much more than the trial, much more than the court, the confines of the court. But what it's allowed us to do when it comes to the book and to testing the arguments, amongst other things, of Lucy Letby's new defence team is to understand what's already been heard at trial, what is new, and you know, where those arguments fit in context. I think that's really critical.
So the most recent development that many people will be aware of is this big press conference held by an international expert panel, which pronounced very firmly that, quote, no murders had been committed. How long ago was this, Judith? Can you remind me?
There have been two significant press conferences held by Lucy Letby's defence team. December of last year was the first one, and then another one in February. Now, the one you're talking about was in February.
Yeah.
And that was the point at which we, having heard that Lucy Letby had engaged a new defence lawyer and that he was speaking himself to new experts, the February press conference was the first point at which we had really the sort of the context and gist of what they were going to be suggesting, I would say, in full. Although the December press conference, you may remember, was when one of the experts working for that team got up, and we just focused on this in the panorama we made recently, got up and essentially accused one of the doctors who was involved in the care of babies at the hospital of having mistakenly ended the life of one of those babies. Now, that was a very bold claim made very early on in the life of this new defence campaign, if you like.
Yeah. And in fact, well, tell us what you discovered about that.
I mean, I think John may well want to get into the weeds of this. A lot of John's work on the science behind this, we've worked together for the last 3 years. And on this particular subject, this is where, right at the start, by the way, when you said this is complicated stuff, it really is. I think anyone who's taken a snap judgment on this material would do well to spend the time we have looking at the real detail of it. And Jonathan spent a lot of time, didn't you, John, looking at the detail around that particular scientific claim and the pathology around it as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you go back to December, a neonatologist, a specialist, got up and said that a needle perforated this baby's liver. Fact, a needle perforated the liver. And he wouldn't be able to sleep at night if he'd been the doctor. Then fast forward to February, this press conference you're talking about, and the experts sort of buried in the report almost, or the summary reports, it says a needle may have perforated the liver. And those same experts offered a different primary theory for what happened to this baby. And of course, in court, that theory, that needle theory, for want of a better term, was examined and was rejected by the jury. And we've spoken to experts independent of Mark McDonald's experts who have said, look, you know, the evidence doesn't support this. So that's just one example, yeah. I think, of what's been going on. But I think quite a powerful example.
Well, I think you describe at some point good people divided on the truth. And I mean, that really is what comes loud and clear from your book, Unmasking Lucy Letby. It also just strikes me throughout that this is an incredible task for any jury. Honestly, Judith, how could a jury of lay people make sense of all this?
Well, what's interesting, actually, Jane, when I think about the jury often, and what must they be making of this, if you like, sort of post-match debate, the post-trial state we're all now in, what we'll never know, by the way, because of course, you know, the law prevents us from knowing the details of what those jurors discuss privately amongst themselves. What we do know, though, is that they took a long time to reach their verdicts. They were deliberating for around a month or so, and they didn't arrive at all of the verdicts in the same fashion. I mean, they weren't unanimous on all of the babies. They acquitted Lucy Letby of two charges. They couldn't decide on a further six at that original trial, and it took them, you know, some time, as I've just said, to get to the finish point. And I think what that tells you is it was difficult. It was very difficult. But we do know, in the prosecution describes some of the evidence in the case as strong. You know, this is the strongest bit of evidence. And there were other pieces of evidence, which, frankly, I think John and I have both got to this point ourselves in the book, would say were not as strong. And you can see that in the way the jury returned their verdicts, I think.
Just very crudely then, I don't care which one of you answers this, because I know you both know all about it. The evidence is all circumstantial against Lucy Letby. At no point was she ever witnessed harming a baby.
That's right, that the closest that anybody got in terms of the evidence, well, there were two moments, but where a mother of one of the babies, the prosecution said, had walked in just after that baby had suffered some sort of injury. But there was not, and also another baby that the prosecution argued that a doctor had walked in just after Lucy Letby attempted to murder a baby. Now, but that's it. There are no eyewitness accounts at any stage of anybody seeing Lucy Letby attack.
If I could just jump in on that, because I think this, for me anyway, this is a very major fact about this case and a reason why it is troubling. Not only did no one see Lucy Letby doing any of these things, no one saw Lucy Letby holding a syringe, suspiciously, even though that was one of the, you know, the murder weapons, according to the convictions. No one saw her tampering with intravenous lines. No one saw her doing any of this. And yet the theories that were accepted by the jury are very elaborate and presuppose that she did all of these very detailed things. Trauma, inflicting violent injuries on babies. Again, no one saw her doing any of that. I think it would be easier to accept that she did these things if people had gone into her background and found that she was interested in serial killers or she had a very obviously dark past. But of course, she doesn't. So you put those two things together, and it is one reason why a lot of people, you know, myself included, you know, struggle with this case.
Well, yes, I absolutely get that. But it is fair to say that she comes across, Judith, as, and I say this slightly hesitantly, as a bit of an oddball, but if my life were pulled apart and forensically examined in every detail, from my choice of duvet cover to the WhatsApp messages I shared, I would also be thought as rather odd. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's impossible, this, to try to read the tea leaves when you're putting it all together. And you know, the prosecution described it as a constellation of evidence. So, yeah, the duvet, the bedroom, photographs of Letby's bedroom were shown in court. The notes that were famously written were pored over. And two sides to every coin, you know, they were shown, these notes that she'd written, I am evil, I did this on purpose. You know, they were shown by the prosecution as confession notes and by the defence as outpourings of anguish by a deeply troubled person. And so everything in the case and the amount of circumstantial evidence we're dealing with here, such as those notes, they're a good example, photographs and other things, are being held up now as problematic because they can be debated on both sides of the coin. And her behaviour, her appearance, the way she handled herself in court and so on, falls under that heading as well.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because she might have helped herself had she behaved in a slightly different way, had she been more emotional. And the truth is that when she appeared in court to give evidence in her own defence, she only appeared tearful when talking about herself, correct?
Yeah, that is right. That's, look, I remember sitting there for months watching it because it was a very notable to me correlation that when the questioning was about herself, not even questioning involving her, but just the evidence was about her, that was when she'd seem upset. It was the very first question that the prosecution barrister put to her when he got up to cross-examine. Why do you only cry when it's about yourself and not about the babies, about the traumatic evidence? Because, I mean, gosh, the evidence in that trial was so harrowing. And you started off quite rightly, Jane, by talking about the parents of the babies. They were in court listening to this for months and months, and it was a very, very traumatic case to listen to. The first thing that the prosecuting barrister said to Lucy Letby was, why do you only get emotional when it's about yourself? And she said, I have got emotional when we're talking about the babies. You know, that doesn't prove anything, does it? It's just somebody's response in the heat of cross-examination. So, yeah, but these details are something that you hang on to because you're trying to, as I just said, read the tea leaves. You're trying to get your head around this enormously complicated case and understand what some of these little signs or clues might give you. But as John's also said, you know, we looked into Lucy Letby's background in the book. You know, we went and with our documentaries and panoramas, we've been to meet people, certainly, you know, friends. We've spoken to friends who grew up with Lucy Letby, who tell us about her background, and she seems to have led a very simple, happy childhood. We don't know the full picture. There are lots of things about this case that we still have questions over. You know, I'm sure there are missing bits of the jigsaw that we don't have the answers to yet. And another big one, just quickly, when it comes to her defence, and we get into this in great detail in the book, is why she did not call any expert to testify. We know that there was a defence expert, Dr. Mike Hall, who was ready and willing to testify on her behalf. Her defence team did not call him, and that is one of the, I think, biggest outstanding questions of this case and missing pieces of the jigsaw.
Judith, do any of the parents of the babies who died want Lucy Letby's case to be re-examined?
Not as far as I know, no. And actually, to the contrary, I mean, look, I can't answer that question precisely on behalf of all of them because we have not spoken to all of them. But what I have done we've spoken to some of them, and in recent months as well, we've been watching their lawyers represent them at the Thirlwall inquiry, the public inquiry looking into the way the hospital dealt with the Lucy Letby situation when doctors raised concerns. Now, at that inquiry, lawyers for those families have been vociferous in their distaste for the campaign to free Lucy Letby. They've said they're certain of her guilt. You know, they say we have our truth. We do not need offers of help from new experts telling us that they have a new truth. They as far as I can tell, to a person, are all absolutely unified that they believe that they have the right verdicts.
And Jonathan, obviously there's such a lot we could talk about here, but are you certain that babies at the Countess of Chester Hospital were deliberately harmed?
No. No. I am not certain of that. I'm not certain of much in this case, actually. It's about degrees of certainty, and I think that's what everybody is arguing about. Anybody who says they're certain about this case or any significant aspect of it, I think, should be treated with some caution. I think there are, as Judith said earlier, I think there are some aspects that are more persuasive than others. I think the insulin evidence is powerful. That's not to say it is absolutely confirmed. But in short, no, I'm not certain. And that is one of the things that has sort of animated my work on this book, is a search for certainty. And I still haven't found it. And the book doesn't pretend to find it.
No, thank you both very much. Really appreciate it. The book is called Unmasking Lucy Letby. It's out in paperback now. The paperback edition has been updated to include recent developments. Jonathan Coffey and Judith Moritz, thank you.
We've got a little bit of a legal theme in this hour of the programme. After the news, our interview is with Alex McBride on season 2 of the real-life courtroom series, The Jury. Let's get the news first with Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Conservatives have accused Nigel Farage of copying their homework after he unveiled Reform UK's immigration plans. Farage pledged to deport all small boat arrivals, including women and children, and to withdraw the UK from the European Convention on Human Rights if he wins the next general election. Sebastian Salek is Labour councillor and commentator and says the proposals are unworkable and morally wrong.
Is this the kind of country we want to be? Is this the nation we are building together? Arresting women and children, he's talking about, removing all of our human rights, paying money and negotiating with the Taliban. That's certainly not a Britain that I want to be behind. And I think most people in this country would agree with me that it is not the kind of Britain we should be building together.
A court heard an asylum seeker told two 14-year-old girls that he wanted to have a baby with them. Hadush Kabatu, who says he's 38, is accused of approaching the teenagers in Epping and Essex in July and denies charging, including of sexual assault. The family of a couple killed in a helicopter crash on the Isle of Wight say they're heartbroken. Justina Choska and Wojciech Kowalkowski were among three people killed when the aircraft came down near Shanklin yesterday. And Poundland has avoided entering administration after a restructuring plan was approved at the High Court. It comes days before the company was due to run out of money. For news when you want it, subscribe to our podcast, The Times News Briefing and The World in 10.
This is Times Radio.
Thanks for a lovely evening. Would you like to come in for a coffee?
Yeah, okay. That'd be lovely.
Oh, gosh, sorry. I didn't mean. I just wanted you to see my new Wickes kitchen. It's just been installed.
At Wickes, our experts will support you every step of the way, from a free kitchen design service through to a professional installation. Plus, with our Spend and Save offer, there's up to 50% off kitchen units. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wickes. Terms and minimum spend apply.
Fly direct to Texas and embark on a truly epic road trip adventure, because there's no place on Earth like the Lone Star State. Explore miles of music, food, and culture from hill country to the Panhandle Plains. Experience cowboy grit, heritage, legendary hospitality, and those unbeatable cinematic sunsets in the great outdoors. Drive and discover your Texan road adventure at TexasFrontiers.com. Expand your frontiers.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Billing Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Now, what goes on in a jury room has to stay in the jury room, but I think we're all intrigued as to how a group of strangers, men and women from all walks of life, get to reach a conclusion that can, in serious cases, deprive somebody of their liberty forever. The Channel 4 series The Jury aims to shine a light on the whole process. In the second series, the show takes a real-life murder trial and reenacts the court proceedings using actors and shortening the amount of evidence placed before the jury. That jury are not acting. They are real people who've agreed to take part. Alex McGride, KC, is one of the experts used in the TV series to shine a light on the legal proceedings, and he is who he says he is. A very good afternoon to you from us. Can you just start by telling us a little bit about the case that this series is based on?
I certainly can, but I'd like to clear up one thing.
Yes.
I'm not a KC.
Oh, what are you?
I will never be a KC.
Okay.
Because I do other things as well. But I am a criminal barrister.
Right. Well, that's good to know. Why would you never be a KC?
Because I haven't jumped through the correct hoops.
Right. Well done.
Yes, indeed.
It means we get to talk to you.
They are very high hoops and extremely narrow and hard to get through.
Okay. Right. Well, I'm very glad we cleared that up. Tell us about the case that this second series is based on.
The case is, did she or didn't she, between a young woman and her partner, and she is accused of murder because after a drunken night out, they go back to her address where he is also living. And in circumstances that are not entirely clear, she stabs him and nicks an artery and he bleeds to death.
For people who didn't see the first series, can you just explain how a TV programme is built around this?
Yes, indeed. The TV programme, what they're interested in doing is focusing on how a jury reaches the verdict that it does and the process that they go through. And that's what they focus on. But they also focus on, of course, the story of what happened. And it was a different sort of case where a husband bludgeons his wife to death with an industrial hammer. Industrial hammers, not normal hammers, they're very heavy. And he was then indeed also charged with murder. And the issue was whether it was manslaughter because he was suffering from a loss of control.
Right. What do you think of the jury system? Is it the best system available to us?
It sure is.
Well, tell us why you believe that.
Of course, the thing about a jury system is I think it's the fairest system because you get 12 people selected at random. It's your fellow citizens deciding on a citizen's guilt or innocence. They come from the widest possible walks of life. They're not all middle-aged men like me. They're not all privately educated. They're people with experience of everyday life who are much more likely to represent not just the defendant, but also the victim and the witnesses in the trial. Because normally people who get involved in criminal cases tend to be young, tend to be disadvantaged, and tend to have all sorts of ancillary problems that a jury who can come from their communities are likely to understand. Also, they're not biased. They've not done the same case 1,000 times before. It's very easy when you slog in and out of the criminal courts to say, oh, I've heard this case before. This person's obviously guilty or this person's obviously not guilty. A jury come fresh. They take the case seriously. They think about it really deeply and really apply not just their minds, but apply their experience of life to the case. And I think that makes for a very fair system indeed.
But what's fascinating about watching this TV kind of adaptation of real life is in the jury room, that personal experience can appear to make people almost intransigent about the evidence that's being placed before them. And I wonder whether you think there's something specific as well about domestic abuse and domestic violence, where some people just hold quite a strong position on whether or not a woman might have provoked that violence, or on the other hand, whether a woman is perfectly entitled to harm someone who previously has harmed her.
Yes, that is indeed a real possibility. I mean, it's a real possibility with a judge as well. I mean, people bring everything that they have into a jury room, and they'll bring their prejudices. You will certainly have misogynists and racists and anti-Semites and people with hang-ups, but you do have 12 people. And what a judge tells a jury before they retire to consider their verdict, that is a system of give and take. They must listen to each other and they must work together collectively to come up to a true verdict according to the evidence. And I can't think of a fairer way of doing that.
Have you never had a case where you've thought the jury have got this wrong?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I certainly have. I've had many cases where I thought the jury have got it wrong, but maybe I'd got it wrong. Very, very few times have I had a case where I had a verdict from a jury where I thought that bears no relation to the evidence at all. I think I can probably count them on one hand, and I've done hundreds and hundreds of criminal trials.
Well, that's very reassuring to hear. How do you get the people with least prejudice or people to take away their prejudice in order to really hear the evidence placed in front of them? Because as you say, we've all got it.
We do all have it, but of course judges have it. Advocates like me, I'm sure, have my prejudices. I certainly wouldn't want me considering my own fate because I know my biases. But the thing about a jury is that they'll have different biases, and they're very unlikely to all have the same biases. And so it cancels that sort of danger out. I certainly concede that with juries is that you can have a jury where they just don't get on, and indeed they just become so at odds with each other, it ends up in being a mistrial and they're discharged, and there has to be another jury and another trial. And that is certainly extremely expensive. But I don't think that's a reason to take away trial by jury. Mm. There's always a good reason for someone to take away your rights. And that is a good reason, but it's not a reason to take away your rights to be tried by your peers.
I thought it was fascinating to watch exactly that play out in the jury room in this TV series, where like-minded people initially get together, don't they? Because they seek safety in numbers. And I wonder, is there any kind of direction for a jury which can stop that happening and to actually kind of break people up and make them go and talk to someone who might not have the same perspective as them? Is anybody ruling a jury room?
No one rules a jury room. No one knows what goes on in a jury room. And one of the reasons I think the programme is so gripping and fascinating is, particularly for a barrister, is you see how a jury actually operates. You see them in action. It's hitherto been a secret place. But there is, built into the system, a judge will tell a jury that they can't discuss the case when they're deliberating, when they retire to consider their verdicts, without everyone being present. So you can't sit in a clique and be thick as thieves and decide an outcome between three or four. You all have to be together when you consider the case.
Right. And what about the influence of modern technology? I know that juries are instructed not to take on board any external influence through Google searches or whatever, but that's almost impossible to police now, isn't it?
I think that's probably true. But I would say there have been cases where jurors have used social media and gone and done their own investigation, and they were actually reported by other jurors, and they ended up going to jail. So a jury is warned very seriously, and it's a very important thing to bear in mind, not to go and do your own research. I'm sure it happens. It's human nature, but it is definitely a dangerous thing. Mm.
We were talking early about the Lucy Letby case. I don't know whether you caught the tail end of the interview, but we were talking to the producer and journalist Jonathan Coffey and Judith Moritz about the book that they have written about that case. And they made the point that for that jury, the amount of medical evidence that they had to sit through and understand and really understand the limitations of certain aspects of neonatal care, the ramifications of certain medicines or procedures. That type of stuff is mind-boggling, Alex. Is it fair to expect people to be able to kind of come up to that mark?
Well, I suppose the easy answer would be to say no until you consider what the other options are. Because no matter what happens, you're going to have non-specialists considering the evidence. You're not going to have a trial by specialist, I think, or trial by expert. I think that would be extremely dangerous thing to do. A judge and a magistrate, as has been proposed recently by Brian Leveson, is for them to consider that, I think, would have the same difficulties and the same problems. The important thing about having a jury, and this is very important for people to understand, is it forces the law courts, the advocates, the judges, the system, to make the case as intelligible as possible. And that's not just for the jury, but also for the defendant sitting in the dock who may have their liberty taken away, and indeed also for the victim and the witnesses. The case has to be clear, the case has to be intelligible, and having a jury forces people like me to make that case as clear as possible. I think most juries can understand medical evidence. I've seen them do it day in, day out for a very long time.
Do you think it's fair to ask somebody to sometimes give up months of their life to these processes?
Probably not, but from an advocate's point of view, one of the funniest things in court is listening to middle-class people coming up with excuses not to sit on a jury for a long time.
Can you tell us? Is it because
expensive holidays,
yeah, the house in Tuscany will fail without me?
Absolutely. Luigi the plumber has to be met at the house in Tuscany. All of that. I think people can, if you have a big enough jury panel, you can find people who have got the time and have got, if I may say, the civic duty, because that's what it is, to take time out of their lives to do what will probably be one of the most important things, if not the most important thing, that they will do in their lives.
What happens if you are a juror on a case that you find so disturbing it actually genuinely upsets your mental health for the rest of your life? Some of the stuff that you must have witnessed yourself being talked about in court, the evidence, the photographs, the videos, whatever they are, you can't unsee stuff like that. What are people meant to do if it really affects them badly?
I think that's a good point. A jury, unlike the advocates, will not see autopsy photographs, will not see anything bloody or unpleasant, but they will certainly hear or could hear extremely upsetting testimony. And one of the things that really struck me about the jury trial was how affected people were. Okay, that you would say, but they're a television jury, but they're hearing a real trial and they're hearing what is a very sad story, an absolute tragedy where there's, you know, there are no winners, least of all the young man who loses his life, or the children who lose their mother, or all these things that come up. I think it's very, very hard. But if a jury has had a bad experience or been on a particularly difficult jury, on a particularly difficult trial, a judge will direct that they don't go back into the jury pool, possibly forever or 10 years, say.
Yeah. And what happens about the money if you're on jury service for, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 months?
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know. I've never been on a jury. I'd love to be on a jury.
OK, so I think there's a daily allowance, isn't there? But I wonder whether this really affects people who are working 0 hours contracts or in the gig economy, you know, where they don't have a decent employer who's going to say, yes, you know, I'll carry on paying you while you go and do this, essentially, community and for the good of society service.
Yes, indeed. But as you said in your question, it is for the good of society. Most trials are not that long. Most trials are a week or so, and I don't think that that's an excessive demand on people. There are longer trials, but most jurors will not experience that. And I think it's surely possible to impanel a jury, find 12 people who've got the time And the inclination to be able to do it.
Yeah. Now, this is a very difficult question to answer, Alex, because we don't want to give away anything about the Channel 4 series. So I know that you'll be perfectly capable of making sure that there's no spoiler here. But isn't one of the main purposes of this TV show and the brilliance of it to actually show that a different set of people might reach a different verdict on exactly the same evidence, which would make people think, oh, I'm not so sure about the validity of every jury trial?
Absolutely. There's no getting away from it. It's spin the wheel of justice. And you might get convicted of murder with one jury and be acquitted and walk out the door free as a bird with another. But the same thing can apply with a judge or magistrates or any system that you have. There's an element of chance. But the element of chance, I would suggest, is not going to make anyone more likely to commit a serious crime, like murder.
OK, well answered. Now, my colleague, has just done a little bit of digging around what you can claim if you're an employee doing jury service. For each day you're at court, you can usually claim up to £64.95, let's round that up to 65 quid, to help you cover your loss of earnings and the cost of any care or childcare outside of your usual arrangements. Well, I'm sorry, but that's going to leave little Tommy and Bobby with no childcare at all after about midday, and £5.71 for food and drink and the cost of travel to and from court. In order to take time off work, give a copy of your jury summons to your employer. Your employer must let you have time off work, but you can ask to delay your jury service if your absence will have a serious effect on their business. OK, this is interesting, isn't it? I do think, Alex, I don't know whether you'd agree with us on this, that actually £65 a day doesn't really go very far these days, does it?
No, it sounds like what junior barristers are paid.
Right. OK, well, that's a neat answer there. But I think an awful lot of people would be very strapped for cash if they were only on 65 quid a day and they had to childcare for their kids, etc., etc. So we know from our conversation then over the last 20 minutes that you are firmly in favour of the jury trial system. But it would be fair to say that some elements of it are under threat, aren't they? Simply because of the cost and the time of a jury trial and a judicial system that has a backlog as far as the eye can see. So what happens?
Well, there is a quite appalling backlog, and we are now listing trials, non-custodial trials, so people who are not in custody, non-remand trials, in 2029, which is insane. But the backlog has got nothing to do with jurors or juries. The backlog is quite simply because the government will not fund the criminal justice system. 20% of courts, that's Crown Courts in England and Wales, are closed. There are not enough judges. There are not enough barristers. And whether you had juries or not, that's not going to change the situation. So it's finding a reason that isn't a reason. I mean, we hear this time and time, we see this time and time again, generally, where you'll blame something that isn't the problem, because it's easy to blame that problem.
But just logically, I'm thinking that you would be able to speed up some of those cases if you change the type of case that always had to have a jury, couldn't you?
I'm not sure it would make that much difference, honestly, because there aren't enough courts and there aren't enough people doing the trials. It physically would not make any difference at all. I mean, I could think of ways that you could change this by going back to, let's say, the 18th century, where they did a trial in 15 minutes. They were hauled in and hauled out.
Yeah, let's not go back to the 18th century,
well,
Alex.
Indeed. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the... if we really wanted to solve the backlog, that would work.
Yeah, but we wouldn't have such good TV as this if we went all the way back 200 years. So
no, indeed.
We wouldn't. Indeed. Do you think you'd make a good juror?
No.
Why not?
Because I'm not even sure barristers are allowed to be, judges are allowed to be on juries, police officers are allowed to be on juries, but I don't think we should be, because we are battle hardened and we have seen so many cases that it's very easy to say, oh, I know exactly what this case is and they're guilty, or I know exactly what this case is and they're not guilty, rather than taking a fresh look at what is to the people involved in the trial incredibly important.
Very good to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much indeed for your time. Criminal barrister Alex McBride. And if you want to follow season two of The Jury on Channel 4, it's stripped across the schedule this week. You can see it tonight at 9 o'clock and then Wednesday, Thursday and concluding on Friday. I think it's well worth your time. Okay. It shines light on something that, as Alex says, we are not allowed to see.
Well, and at any time, we could get one of those letters, couldn't we?
We could.
Calling us up, because I haven't done jury service, apart from an inquest jury when I was 19.
And I've deferred it twice. Once because it genuinely would have meant that I'd fallen off a course I wouldn't be able to get back on.
Right.
And the other time because I had recently had a baby and I was breastfeeding.
Yeah, well, I think that's perfectly reasonable. I should say that gov.uk says if the jury service lasts longer than 10 working days, you can claim more money. You can claim £129.91.
We're going to call that 130.
I really do think we should round these figures off. I know we're strapped for cash, but please. Right, it's Times Radio, 3 minutes to 4.
Listen to Times Radio on your smart speaker. Just say, play Times Radio.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.75% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
For a whole year, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that countryside getaway with the family. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.65% gross. Terms apply.
By river, ocean and expedition, you can now explore all 7 continents with Viking. Start planning your journey today and discover for yourself why Viking was named Best River Cruise Operator and Best Luxury Ocean Cruise Operator at the 2024 Times and Sunday Times Travel Awards. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
As a small business owner, you've got to be ready for the ups and the downs. Ready to think on your feet, ready to be rushed off your feet, ready to make the big decisions and make the tea. 2 sugars in mind? Ta. Ready to be there for your customers whenever they need you. Well, ditto. Virgin Media Broadband's ready for anything business can throw at it. Yeah, it's business ready broadband. Search Virgin Media Business Broadband.
Award-winning journalist Anna Mihailova has joined Times Radio as our new political editor.
From September, I'll be putting rocket boosters under our political coverage, and there's going to be no shortage of really important stories to bring you. MPs return from their summer breaks, and Parliament will be back in full swing, with huge political debates looming over illegal migration and how on earth to balance the books in a time of such low growth.
Hear intelligent political analysis and opinion with Anna Mihailova on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
And we're going to be talking to Anna Mihailova, I think, next week on the programme, aren't we? And tomorrow's big guest is only Ray Mears. He is a woodsman and an instructor, and he'll be teaching us all about his numerous crafts at around 3:30 tomorrow.
Something that you'll put immediately into action as soon as you go back to the wilderness of East West Kensington.
Absolutely, yes. As I hunt down my favourite loaf in Lidl, I'll be looking to Ray Mears for advice.
Stand back, everybody.
That's tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening. Who shall we thank today?
Thank Hugo Chambray. Let's also thank Charlie and Ryan and Rosie and Eve, and that's quite enough. Thank you, Jane.
Thank you. John Pienaar is next. We're back tomorrow. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee, and thank you, Jane. It's 4 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. Nigel Farage has warned the small boats crisis is a threat to public order, claiming the arrival of migrants is an invasion. And relatives of a woman killed in a helicopter crash on the Isle of Wight say they're struggling to cope with the loss and are asking for help bringing her body back to Poland. Coming up, what is it, Reform UK's deportation plan? How workable is it? We'll be looking at the politics of it, the impact on those coming to the country. country and claiming asylum, and how countries across Europe deal with this issue, and a worrying economic outlook in France. And how politically safe is Benjamin Netanyahu?
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Reform UK leader Nigel Farage says if elected, he'll send 600,000 illegal immigrants back to their home country within the first 5 years. He outlined plans to leave the European Convention on Human Rights and other international treaties. Illegal immigrants would be arrested when they arrive, detained and then deported to countries including Afghanistan and Eritrea. Reform would also build accommodation for 24,000 people on surplus military bases. He claims there's total despair and rising anger about the issue around the country. And he says he'll deal with it if he becomes PM.
The only way we will stop the boats is by detaining and deporting absolutely anyone that comes via that route. And if we do that, the boats will stop coming within days.
Kemi Badenoch has said leaving the ECHR isn't a plan in itself and it could destabilise the UK. Times' chief political correspondent, Aubrey Allegretti, said there were significant gaps in the detail of the speech.
We were asking things like which disused RAF bases that Nigel Farage has claimed could be used to both house people who've been detained and then deport them. Would reform use? We didn't get an answer to that. We asked, how far back would you go? So, for example, if you're somebody who arrived here as an illegal immigrant 10, 20 years ago and you'd had a child who was born in the UK, would both of you be deported? And he suggested that that was a complex system. He didn't have all of the answers.
The daughter of a horse riding instructor who died in a helicopter crash on the Isle of Wight has said that she was the best mum you could ask for. Justyna Choska and Wojciech Kowalkowski were among three people killed when the helicopter came down in a field near Shanklin during a flying lesson. Choska had bought the lesson as a gift for her partner to realise his lifelong dream of flying. Prosecutors allege an asylum seeker attempted to kiss a teenage girl and invite her back to the hotel he was being housed in Epping in Essex in July. Hadush Kabatu, who says he's 38, denies all the charges, including sexual assault. There are warnings that a potential government definition of Islamophobia could create a blasphemy law by the back door. Fayez Mughal of the anti-Muslim hate organisation Tell Mama is campaigning against Angela Rayner's plan to come up with a formal definition. The former anti-extremism czar Lord Walney told Times Radio the move could have a chilling effect.
There's a real danger with this definition that it imposes effectively an increase in the climate of fear and caution around talking about issues that we have to get to grips with now in our society.
More Poundland shops are going to close despite a restructuring plan being approved in court, saving it from collapse. Lawyers argued the high street retailer would have run out of money by the 7th of September if it hadn't secured £60 million in new funding. The sites which will shut have been identified, with a further 16 to follow. For news when you want it, subscribe to our podcast, The Times News Briefing and The World in 10.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, John Pienaar, at Drive, on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. If you want to grab a headline, and Nigel Farage is very good at that, you can warn that the country is on the brink of serious civil disorder, violence on the streets. And he did, several times. If you need another startling promise, how about promising to deport north of 650,000 migrants over 5 years? 650,000. Vastly more than the 30-odd thousand in migrant hotels and the 100-odd thousand applying to remain. It would include, presumably, hundreds of thousands who've arrived without permission but who've since been granted the legal right to stay. Now, that is tougher than Donald Trump, isn't it? His plan to solve the problem of asylum seekers on small boats was nothing if not simple. Arrest them all the moment they step on British soil and deport them straight away, all of them. They wouldn't get stuck in asylum hearings and appeals because they wouldn't be allowed to claim asylum. And whether it's possible to round up and keep under guard all the asylum seekers and presumably their children till they're sent away, well, that's a detail. Could old army bases be used as detention camps? That's another detail. They're quite a tricky one. There was an answer to the question, what do you do with asylum seekers who came here to escape death or torture by the oppressive regime at home? And the answer? was, that's not our problem. This policy is about giving Brits what they want and protecting Brits from illegal migrants they see as a threat. Farage and his team refer to the migrants as mostly men of what they called fighting age. So, if this was a plan to get attention, it has. If it's about trying to keep the pressure on the government when most people already think Labour's handling the problem badly, well, it may well do that. Would it turn out to be a vote winner, even a power winner? Well, that's up to you. And up to voters, of course, when they decide whether ridding the country of asylum seekers matters more than treating them by the rules and standards of compassion that have guided, Reform UK says, constrained governments and migration rules for so long. Where are you on this? Nigel Farage's challenge today. Where are you? Whose side are you on? Tell me what side you consider yourself to be on. Send me a text, 8722, start with the word Times, or a tweet to @TimesRadio. So let's just look back on what happened a little earlier on. There he was, Nigel Farage, outlining those Reform UK plans to tackle illegal migration, saying he'd send, well, we were told, north of 650,000 illegal immigrants back to their home country within the first 5 years. Farage repeatedly said that public order was under threat.
Without somehow the contract was in the government and the people being renewed, without some trust coming back, then I fear deeply that that anger will grow. In fact, I think there is now, as a result of this, a genuine threat to public order. And that is the very last thing that we want.
Well, he also set out the Reform Party's plan to use military bases to solve the issue.
The military bases that we will use, people will be detained. They won't be out walking the streets on the road to being deported. So I would suggest to you that whichever geographical locations are chosen, local residents will be far less concerned by this plan than they would young men being free 24 hours a day to walk through their village or walk through their town.
If Reform came to power, said Nigel Farage, they would repeal the Human Rights Act and quit the Refugee Convention.
What really bothers me is, and you've seen this from the Bell Hotel onwards, the growing concern with justifiable evidence that